have a mandate here that I perhaps won't be able to carry out in 20 minutes, which is to explain what is the FTAA. In trying to give you the fruit of my cogitations of this last summer. Perhaps this would be a disaster, such as weather, same as the weather in the Mediterranean. It would be up to you to decide. Today the weather is nice, and I don't want to spoil your day. The idea that I've been trying to develop is to try and explain how all of this holds together, how the form of negotiations is part of the content of the negotiations. The content of this negotiation, Hector, as I said, and Renato also mentioned it, which is this is basically clandestine and secret. I'm going to try and explain why it's like that. And to try and bring this form of negotiation, which is secret, together with the content of the negotiation, what's on the table. And this is what I would like to try and develop, doing this the following way. I'm going to do this like a professor here, give you the context of the FTAA, talk about the what is original FTAA, afterwards to be able to come to thoughts on trying to understand what are the issues of the FTAA. So the FTAA, the negotiations are going forward very well. Hector mentioned this. This is what they tell us. The document could be ready quite quickly. We're talking about February of 2001. And when we think about this is quite surprising, because there was a first NAFTA, the first Reagan and Romney started in 85, and it took 4 years for two sides to come to a negotiation. And then in 91, it took 3 years for a tripartite negotiation with Mexico. In 94, the Santiago Plan came through, but the negotiations for the FTAA really only started in 98, and this would be a text that would be ready 3 years later. If we take into account the results of the elections in the Americas from here to then, and it could be, some people say I'm pessimistic, it could actually be signed in April 2001. It could be absolutely ready. What won't be ready is that the political players in this and the confrontation about this on this agreement between Brazil and the United States, and I'll explain why. So something very important to mention in passing here is the incredible efficacy of the negotiation at the level of all of the Americas when we compare it to the worldwide, for example, the failure in Seattle, the pepper spray in the APEC, and all the various documents that have been Mrs. Stevenson, Southern Methodist University in March of last year, said that this was voluntary, that these negotiations are going on quietly because they're working very well. And this is something that's essential to mention. And what's going on in the terms of this negotiation, why are we talk about this, why don't we just let the economists worry about it? The first negotiations between Canada and the United States during the 80s, you can realize that Canada and the United States, although we're already integrated one with each other, couldn't really have the same type of concerns for signing this and with this and with other things that have got 2,000 years of history around them, like in Europe, for example, or the history in Latin America, which are barely in economic contact with each other. So the Canadians and Americans, as of 85, is something surprisingly original, but it's also brilliant on the part of the Americans to have thought at some point, at the same time that they were negotiating at the world level, to have the strategy to have a sub rosa negotiation at the continental level with their neighbors in Canada. And this is not hadn't been seen before. Canadians like to have security of access, and the Americans are looking for something else. What do the Americans want? I'll explain what the Americans want. I think that the best text that we have today isn't the 89 agreement, because it's interesting to follow them, because there's an agreement with Israel in 85, another one in 84, and we think that the chef d'oeuvre is NAFTA. NAFTA is, to such a point, a perfect agreement that it is Chapter 11 that one wanted to develop into the MAI independently, and we'd also like to do something independent that would be sanctioned by the WTO. The NAFTA is a jewel Why? For basically for two reasons. There are various reasons, but two major reasons. And one is chapter 10 and chapter 11. But on something a little beyond what we do, this is what a professor is. He wastes his time thinking. I tried to show you the link between the two of them. I hadn't seen them. It just came to me in a flash recently. Chapter 10, for the first time in the history of humanity, it does something quite ingenious here. What it did was it set up on a negative approach. What we heard for the first time in the history of humanity, that what we had negotiated in before in treaties was the positive approach. What does this mean? This is very interesting, but what does it mean? When you're negotiating, usually what you put on the paper, the terms of the negotiation. NAFTA did something very original, which was that, for example, when it's talking about services, a very short chapter with five or six articles. Most favored status applies to all services. Everything is covered by the agreement. So if you have exceptions, then you put them in an appendix, which is exactly the opposite of what we had always done. So you're going to say, so what? As we say in English, the so what here is that in the agreement, there's one article, 1024, that foresees that the exceptions will be valid until 33rd December of 1998. And that since 31st of December 98, there are 30 continental committees that are carrying on the negotiations of the NAFTA. Did you know that? Uh-huh. Now you know because I just told you. Who are these committees? What are they doing? When do they meet? This is fascinating. I'll come back to this and say a few words afterwards. They have meetings. They publish communiques. They're in constant contact with the business world to try and privatize services. This is the first and great innovation of this system. To go along with this, we sanctioned Chapter 11 on investment. Chapter 11, we turned it into a demon. Chapter 11, what it says, that it's the Charter of Rights of the investor. It's there because we have Chapter 10 before it. It's there because we liberalize all services. So private investment is going to enter into the services. High accounting, investigation in whatever hospital, and all these things. The government can't change their mind afterwards, so we have to lock the system in, this liberalization. So there's a very surprising complementarity between chapters 10 and 11. This is about the major innovations included in the NAFTA. There's a third, which is perhaps worth mentioning, at least for Quebec, is NAFTA proposes that the governments are committed to negotiate with local and provincial governments so that it doesn't just function at the central federal level, but that it trickle down through all levels of society. It's also something that we don't really hear about, the complementarity of the NAFTA in the Canadian context is the internal commerce agreement. So we have a double NAFTA. We have an external one, an internal one. We know a little bit about NAFTA, but we don't even know that we have this agreement of internal trade agreement that the 10 provinces have negotiated, that they've all accepted. It was Johnson who, well, during his short period in power, the PQ adopted it by decree when they came into power and confirmed it 2 hours a place. With legislation that they passed it very quickly because the liberals saying very quickly, you see, it's federalism works very well, et cetera, we don't like it. So then they started to go towards internal free trade. So both of those exist. So everybody knows the NAFTA. I don't know why we hear very little about the other one. That's something else we could discuss later. So these are the original aspects of this new negotiation regime. So I don't want to go too far without. The internal trade agreement has the same type of clauses as the NAFTA, so it's quite symmetrical. So what about the FTAA? Why is it going so quickly? What's happening is that, contrary to several discussions, the ministerial declarations and negotiation is going on in Miami. Madame Stevenson and text, which is produced by the Organization of American States. There are 900 negotiators in Miami to work on this text, so that when we see what's going on, the nine different negotiator groups, each which is working on one chapter of the NAFTA. And this is, again, something interesting, coming back to what I said before, why is it secret? it's very interesting to see that I have the impression at times that we cannot say that our politicians are more cynical than they actually are. The negotiations have a certain autonomy. They know more or less know what's going, what they're negotiating. They're more or less interested in knowing what's going on. And we can think that this is perfect because if the negotiation is being done against experts, what's better than an expert? It shouldn't be the experts that should make the negotiation go forward. So we would be able to get up to the ideal standards because it's the most brilliant people in the galaxy who would be involved here. And I would have to, I'm sorry if I have to disillusion everybody, but those experts aren't working alone. There's an organization that has a privileged access to all the negotiations, the American Business Forum. And when you look at the writings of the American Business Forum, I have just a small extract here. Perhaps I'm not going to actually read it, but within the text that they have, the American Business Forum is important to mention because they're not only very present in negotiation, but also to see how useful they are. So it's not a very objective negotiation, and as long as the negotiation is carrying out with one player who's privileged above the others, we see perhaps why it has to be clandestine and why the contact with the civil society is done afterwards. And so we have to know very well what is the utility of businessmen that are right very close to the negotiation. They decided that there would not be a parallel summit because they do the same thing. They have a parallel summit that's a spreading disease. They would have one before all these social groups and between all their adversaries, environmentalists and trade unionists, etc., in Miami, but perhaps right after, that with their first ministerial meeting in Denver. So it's very interesting to see that they won't be in Quebec because they're very clever. You know where they'll be? They'll be in Buenos Aires a month before because that's where it's going to be. When they arrive in Quebec, everything will be done already. So there won't be two in parallel, the business people and the governments. There'll be just the other summits. So I just wanted to underline these other elements as a result of our secret negotiations. What is very interesting to underline here is the presence of a negotiation which is selective with the business world on one side and the negotiation as an organization on the other side. But what I wanted to say, and I'm going to jump forward in my argument here, is that with this system, we find the setting up as a provocative fashion, more and more provocative, of an actual confederal vision of North America. In any case, in how this confederal vision is beginning to spread throughout all of the Americas. What does a confederal vision mean? The idea is as follows, that if contrary to what we think and contrary to what we know, we have a supranational political regime in North America at this time, as of now. Is that clear? This includes the three classical elements of power that have been defined by Montesquieu: legislative, executive, and judicial. The executive, the continental executive power, are the summits, the meetings of the three heads of state, followed by meetings of the ministries of foreign affairs, commerce, etc., supported by these committees that continue negotiating the NAFTA, these 30 committees that are at this time negotiating. So there's an executive with its bureaucracy that continues working on NAFTA as we're talking. There's a continental judicial power that it was put together with all the different courts, the courts of experts, etc., where very often the decisions are secret, where the complaints are secret. Purolator, for example, the Purolator, or UPS, excuse me, against Purolator and Canada Post, it's not possible to see the text there. It's a secret complaint, and in this complaint, UPS attacks the contract between the two, but also the fact that Canada Post is part of the services that the Canadian government is trying to protect in its list of appendix. Postal services is one of the things being protected, so the same logic is going for it. And they're going to tell me, Brunel, you're going to be saying that Fox hasn't said this yet. We don't have the North American Parliament. I'm going to say, yes, there is one. It's the U.S. Senate, which is the only parliament that has control over its head of state, and which is the one that adopts legislation openly, and which is the one that is putting forward an extraterritorialization of American laws through this brilliant mechanism. So you perhaps can realize the extent of the FTAA in this context. The FTAA is simply the extension of the parameter of these three to all 34, with the idea that the Senate will be able to maintain this central characteristic of American dominance over the world, and it will be the internationalization of their own standards, or as it was very well said by Thomas Friedman, nothing to do with Milton. From on the right, Thomas Friedman ends an editorial saying, globalization is us. It's the Americans, it's nobody else. And once we understand that, once we can understand this as a central thesis, we'll have already made a great step forward. So I'm going to sum up. So what do we have to see in what we're trying to do against the FTAA? I think we have to take advantage of it to denounce this clandestine system, to go towards the logic that exists within the NAFTA, to allow our other comrades that what they're going, the secret present in the secret negotiation, why is it secret? Why is the system like this? In the United States, it's very open. It's secret for others because the others are negotiating in secret. The norms that the standards that Congress suggests for them, the American business are much closer than one would think. And we'd have to go through the social history of the United States to say that it's lobbies that are close to the Congress and not the people. So this is a very coherence in the system, and this coherence needs to be showed up and denounced. And this is why, for us, it's very important, if we're going to take over the origins of the NAFTA, add in the two different directions of this neoliberal policy, and the liberalization, free trade, and the internal tendency, which is privatization of social services. And if we can look parallel liberalization through the exterior, privatization in the internally, then perhaps we can open again the Pandora box on the question of privatization and the role of the of NAFTA, and perhaps the role of the ITA, because I have to mention this, it's very easy to criticize the social alliance, because we're saying, listen, you have your NAFTA, you like the NAFTA, but you don't want other countries to have the joy of participating in the NAFTA. And when there's such an argument, we have to look at things, run it ahead of such a criticism, that if we're against FTAE, of course, once again, we have to take another look at NAFTA and start talking at the same time about the ITA or the internal treaty trade agreement. So we will be able to center our efforts on in trying to foresee the manifestations and demonstrations that we would like to organize for April 2001. I'm talking in the plural here, because one thing that seems to concern me, I'd just like to share my torment with you. I'm not particularly worried. There's going to be a lot of people, a colossal number of people in Quebec in 2001. But we have a huge amount of work to do in training and information, so that there'll be some effect between now and then, because it's a bit of a festive ritual. I'm in favor of this. I'm in favor of the virtual festive ritual. Every time they get together, we go out there, and then we get arrested, and et cetera. But we have to go, as of now, try and go beyond that, and bringing out the true debate. What type of democracy will we have in America with what is going to happen here? It's if this executive democracy has an aim. It's not a coincidence that the parliaments are completely outside of the process, because they don't really have nothing to do in America, these parliamentary assemblies. We were at the meeting, the general meeting, the parliamentaries are panicking. The executives, in order to legitimize and to bring in the civil society, they're just saying, well, we're doing our jobs, the executives say that. But I think that people are realizing this a little bit too late. So we saw this in spring. You're going to see it again in the fall. The hearings by the National Assembly. For one, as a group of a research group, we're going to go there. Others will be going there. And I think that what we need to show up clearly is what is going on. And I'll end on this note. Thank you.